I'm Afshin Ratansian. Welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world. From the UAE, today marks the 36th anniversary of the 1989 US invasion of Panama, where Washington killed civilians, overthrew a government, and arrested longtime CIA asset Manuel Noriega, who had spent years trafficking drugs with the backing of US intelligence agencies. Today, Trump has assembled the biggest armed buildup since the Panama invasion to threaten the country with the largest known proven oil reserves, Venezuela. The excuse is drugs, which no one believes. The US has a history of drug dealing, and according to Gary Webb, a history of using drugs to neutralize civil rights back home in the USA. Neither does anyone believe US assertions that Venezuela is used by Middle East resistance groups. At least Trump's release of the US national security strategy this month makes Trump's Monroe Doctrine explicit. The entire Western Hemisphere must be enslaved by Washington. And at least Trump's new zones of influence policy may explode NATO illusions about defeating Russia in Ukraine, risking global thermonuclear annihilation. But a war on Iran is never far away as long as Netanyahu prolongs the Gaza genocide and uses ISIS-linked events to provoke a US region-wide war here in West Asia. Joining me again is Max Blumenthal, editor of The Gray Zone. Max, thanks so much for coming back on. I want to get onto Gaza, Venezuela, Ukraine, how the pretext of certain events could be used for a war in Iran. But can I just begin about how happy you must be at Kash Patel's FBI neutralizing the Turtle Island Liberation Front, which would have destroyed Los Angeles or at least Amazon logistics plants in the run-up to Christmas and New Year?
Yeah, I'm really relieved that Kash Patel has done something other than protect his girlfriend, Alexis Wilkins, from internet bullies and has saved America from this ferocious onslaught of leftist Antifa terrorism in the form of the Turtle Island Liberation Front, an organization that does not actually exist, which consists of a single Los Angeles-based Instagram group that was created in Los Angeles with less than 1,000 followers who appear to be four dupes for a manufactured terror plot in which the FBI sent a confidential human informant who is very well paid, who had been an informant in several other plots the FBI created, to lead these dupes into the desert, then laid out a bunch of material on a table in the Mojave Desert, said to be bomb-making material, none of which could have possibly made complex pipe bombs. The only thing we saw on the table related to pipe bombs were PVC pipe. There were no end caps, which are required for pipe bombs by the FBI's own admission, and they busted them all. And they're actually being charged for conspiracy and not even terrorism. Pam Bondi has hailed this as this gigantic bust against Antifa, but it's pretty obvious what's going on here, which is that the FBI and Trump's Department of Justice are fabricating the threat of left-wing terrorism in order to implicate the left and justify mass repression in the United States, the same way the second Bush and Obama administrations fabricated the threat of jihadist terror. Over 90% of terror plots throughout the Bush and Obama era were manufactured by the FBI, according to terror expert Trevor Aronson.
So we can expect more busts, perhaps related to fake anti-Semitism. I know the world has been watching the atrocity in Australia, a British colony founded, of course, on genocide itself. We're approaching 100 years since the Coniston Massacre, when Aboriginal men, women and children were killed. What did you immediately think, before we get to the massacre itself, of the fact that Netanyahu was so quick to exploit it, an ISIS-linked attack, presumably a war on Iran?
Yeah, I should have mentioned in the case of the FBI bust, Free Palestine stickers were placed in the photos next to the bomb-making materials. So obvious attempt to also include Palestine solidarity activism as the perp. Now we see the same thing in Australia, and we've been seeing this for months leading up to this very real and horrific mass shooting in Bondi Beach. And I've been saying for the past 2 years, just by checking the pulse and feeling the vibe of Zionist reactions to the world after October 7th, that fanatical Zionists have actually been, I don't even know if it's subconscious, have been kind of yearning for a mass casualty event where they could finally point the finger at all of the enemies of Israel and shut down all of their critics. And here they have it. And they have proven my point. Rather than point the finger at the actual perpetrators of this crime, who appear to be a father and son team of Salafists who have allied with ISIS, who actually were known as ISIS sympathizers to Australian state security for over 6 years and were nevertheless granted multiple firearms licenses, which allowed them to carry out this attack. They're blaming Australian Prime Minister Anthony Albanese, who recognized a Palestinian state. They're blaming Zohran Mamdani, the new mayor of New York. They're blaming the Palestine Solidarity Movement, all the Australian citizens who marched in this historic march against the Israeli genocide, the Bridges March. They're blaming Iran, of course, and Israeli intelligence is investigating Iran. Netanyahu is directly blaming Albanese, and it completely proves my point that Zionists have been almost lusting for this kind of attack because anti-Semitism is the fuel of Zionism, which ultimately allows the Zionist movement to justify Israel as a sanctuary for the world's Jews. If the world were a safe place for Jews where we were living in normalcy, then they wouldn't be able to do that. So this environment has to be cultivated. And prior to this horrific attack, which was stopped by a Muslim hero from Syria, there had been suspicious incidents of anti-Semitic vandalism all across Australia, as mainstream media at one point about a year ago, last January, was documenting, and it sort of, the documentation fell off the radar. Actually, Anthony Albanese, the prime minister, referred to paid actors, in his words, who were being paid by a foreign entity through cryptocurrency to attack Jewish targets in Australia. The shadow home secretary of the opposition made the same declaration. So what were these targets? One target was the Addis Israel Synagogue in, I believe, Melbourne, which is home to a kind of anti-Zionist sect. So not exactly the choice target for someone who really hates Israel. No injuries, no one was wounded. And ultimately, the criminals responsible for this were apolitical people, many of them mentally disturbed. There were another series of incidents where apolitical, semi-homeless people were arrested, and all of them said they were being paid to do this. And Iran was blamed after the Israeli Mossad provided Australia's ASIO, its intelligence agency, with a so-called tip. So let's put the pieces together. A foreign entity is paying a criminal class in Australia with no political ideology to attack Jewish targets. Who would benefit from that? It certainly wouldn't be Iran. And why would Iran attack an anti-Zionist synagogue? It doesn't make sense. Yet Australia was pressured to eject the Iranian ambassador, which was the culmination of a long-standing Israeli campaign to fracture relations between Australia and Iran. And so that campaign continues through the Bondi massacre.
Yeah, no so far revealed links between the ISIS-linked assailants and the security services. It's not like Ariana Grande's The Manchester concert, which was intimately right. connected with the Libya fighting group, trained with connections to MI6. I don't want to talk too long about Australia, but I should just mention that whilst, obviously, we don't back the atrocity, it's terrible for all the people that were killed, Australia arms the F-35s and the R-400 remote weapon systems that are used on Gaza. A rabbi was killed, and the Hanukkah celebrations were the Chabad Lubavitch movement. Who is that? What is that Chabad Lubavitch movement? We should say that Judaism is not one kind of generalized thing that you can just say that's a Jew. There are many different communities within Judaism.
Well, of course, and there are many people of diverse perspectives who were targeted in this attack, simply for being Jewish. And, you know, Jews are increasingly targeted and resented because of Israel's attempt to claim the mantle of world Judaism. and claim to be the global voice of Judaism as Israeli soldiers now take gigantic Hanukkah menorahs into the ruins of Gaza and light gigantic candles over the destroyed homes of people they massacred. There was a lighting of a menorah in the occupied West Bank city of Tulkarm. These kind of displays encourage anti-Semitism. Israel is the singular engine of anti-Jewish attitudes, and by design, because it justifies Israel's existence to cultivate anti-Jewish hatred outside these the Spartan fortified frontiers that Israel controls. So you have one of the casualties in Bondi Beach, a rabbi for the Chabad-Lubavitch movement, which is deeply intertwined with Israel's fascistic settlement enterprise. The Chabad-Lubavitch movement believes in that Palestinians essentially are not human. They work closely with the Israeli military. And this rabbi himself had gone to Gaza and participated in the genocide, blessing Israeli soldiers as they destroyed homes, as they massacred civilians. Nothing justifies his death, but at the same time, I'm not going to memorialize or honor a figure like this. I actually was, the Chabad-Lubavitch movement attempts to proselytize within Judaism. And so they actually targeted me for proselytization when I was much younger, and I got to know them and understand their genocidal attitudes. It's something that helped turn me against Zionism. So this is a movement that is also very closely connected with the Trump administration, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner. These are some of the Chabad fellow travelers. It's a very influential and fascistic movement. And, you know, we should be honest about what it is.
Yeah. I mean, you mentioned the hero who prevented more killing, apparently, from Idlib in Syria. Laura Loomer, who apparently is able to walk into the Oval Office and talk to Donald Trump, said, no, this wasn't a Muslim. I mean, this is being broadcast a day after the scheduled release of the Epstein emails. Do you believe the Epstein emails still have a power over this administration, as well as the Rubios and Ratcliffes that infest the Trump administration?
Well, the photos showing Jeffrey Epstein posing for selfies with Steve Bannon demonstrate the continued power, because the MAGA movement had extracted so much from the emails during the Trump, and the concept of the Epstein files during the Trump campaign, all the promises from Kash Patel and FBI Deputy Director Dan Bongino to get to the bottom of this elite pedophile conspiracy that was ultimately going to expose Soros and Clinton and the left, have blown back on Trump and destroyed, utterly destroyed his mystique among his own base, because it's under Trump's orders that Patel and Bongino and Pam Bondi are
always omitting the Israel connection as well.
Well, everyone's omitting the Israel connection except for independent outlets who have been probing the Handala leaks, which are emails that were extracted from the personal email account of Ehud Barak, which show his close partnership with Jeffrey Epstein and how Epstein was at least an Israeli intelligence adjacent figure. But The Trump mystique is gone. And now, today, you're seeing Donald Trump face very harsh criticism and consternation from key MAGA influencers, including Ann Coulter, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Nick Fuentes, for his disgusting comments about Rob Reiner.
Max Blumenthal, I'll stop you there. More from the editor of The Gray Zone after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still here with the editor of The Gray Zone, Max Blumenthal. Max, you were talking about the forlorn situation that Trump finds himself in. I don't know how well you thought he did when, this is the Sulzberger New York Times here, U.S. casualties make it harder to unify Syria. That doesn't even make sense as a headline. U.S. casualties make it harder to unify Syria. It doesn't make any sense. But of course, Sergeant Edgar Torres Tovar and Sergeant Nate Howard and others, American soldiers killed in Syria. Do you think Trump knew that there were soldiers still in Syria? Why are there U.S. soldiers in Syria under the Trump administration? Have they hidden it from him? And do you think he's going to finally tire of Jilani, despite calling him a tough guy and having invited him to the Oval Office this year?
Well, the neocons in the first Trump administration, James Jeffrey, for example, openly boasted that they lied to Donald Trump about the total of soldiers in northeastern Syria who were stealing Syria's oil. Trump believed there were 900 as he worked for a troop withdrawal, and there were actually 1,800. So Trump is still being rolled and lied to, and it's not just in Syria, it's in Venezuela as well, where he was sort of rolled into deploying the USS Gerald Ford, and now the Marco Rubio contingent, Rubio did this through his position at the NSC, is saying, well, Trump, you have 10% of U.S. naval assets in the Caribbean. You can't just turn around and do nothing. It would look weak and Maduro would win. So Trump is now trapped there. He's been consistently trapped in Syria. And who are they firing at in Syria? Because the Trump administration has freely welcomed the government of Ahmed al-Sharia, aka Mohammed al-Jolani, the deputy founder of ISIS, as they try to hunt down ISIS cells in a country that's essentially a pro-US Islamic State government that was brought to power by a 10-year-long CIA-backed dirty war. Does the American public understand this? Can it make sense to them? No. Does the Venezuela deployment, where the U.S. is now seizing giant tankers apparently filled with fentanyl, or maybe it's oil, does that make sense to the American public? No, over 70% of the American public opposes it. So Trump's foreign policy is essentially the third coming of the first term of the second George Bush administration, and the American public totally rejects it, along with Donald Trump's disgusting persona as he celebrates a beloved Hollywood director, the director of Stand By Me and Misery, getting his throat slit by a drug addicted son when so many Americans are dealing with addiction in their families. This administration is so out of touch. It's basically over by this point, but we still have 3 more years left of it.
Rob Reiner, the Harry Metzali director, who I should also say that no one should ever negotiate with Palestinians resistance movements during the genocide in a separate issue. The Financial Times, Venezuela.
Well, I mean, his politics were horrible, but that's beside the point.
Of course. And he made some great films. Venezuela plea, Nobel winner calls for action. I mean, the media is starting and then started to subside the propaganda, Iraq WMD style, against Venezuela. How well do you think Maduro is playing it? He's keeping quiet, relatively quiet. He's allowing boats, Venezuelan fishermen, to be killed. He hasn't reacted, even though the Americans have invaded Venezuelan waters. How well do you think he's playing it so far?
Well, the American media wants Maduro to come out as a ferocious militant, and Maduro is doing everything to defy them by singing along to Bobby McFerrin's Don't Worry, Be Happy at a mass rally of campesinos and farmers, part of the mass base of the Chavista movement that's still alive in Venezuela. He doesn't speak very good English, and so he calls for peace, not war, in English, which has been turned into a kind of techno remix playing at some clubs in Caracas. This is part of a, I'd say, fairly effective PR strategy in which Maduro is seeking a deal and an accommodation with the U.S. in place of the disaster that would come if Marco Rubio and the South Florida Gusano Industrial Complex got its way. It would be a cross between Gaza and Colombia if they got their way, and civil war would erupt. There'd be a new migrant wave. But at the same time, Venezuela's government understands, because the U.S. is looking for a pretext, that they have to withstand attacks that no other country would, whether it's the killing of their own citizens. 8 more were killed. We don't know who they are. There's no due process, to the seizure of their oil tankers. 4 oil tankers from Russia, including tankers carrying parts and substances needed to refine oil, have been turned away from Venezuela, and they are now effectively under siege. And the only way
out of
this...
Russia do a bit more? There were unconfirmed reports of a Russian Navy being there, but could Russia and China be doing a lot more? And should they have done a lot more before the flotilla was being slowly assembled? They apparently have to act, before Christmas, before they need refueling in some way, or just retreat out of the Caribbean in this largest flotilla since the Panama invasion?
Well, Russia's heavily invested in the Orinoco Belt, and China has a lot of investments in Venezuelan minerals and has a lot to gain in infrastructure through its Belt and Road. Venezuela has diversified its international relations since the Chavez era, and yet they haven't sent a strong message, the kind of message that Russia sent, I think, 2 or 3 years ago when it flew strategic bombers from Moscow to Caracas. And that's the kind of message that could be sent to the United States, that they're not going to allow this kind of war to take place. But Russia's in a different place now because of the Ukraine proxy war, because of the deal that it's seeking with the Trump administration to basically wind the war down. And the focus, the focus of its sheer military brawn within its own frontier, within its own realm. So they may not want to exert muscle in Venezuela, but they have a lot to lose there.
Yeah, I mean, some might say that Russia actually don't particularly want a deal. They just want to go on and finish the war in its own time, given that Europe, just tell me what you've thought of the European reaction to, the national security strategy of Trump playing for real. The document may have only just come out in the past couple of weeks, but it's happening. And Western Europe, they're talking about conscription.
They've been talking about this for months, if not the past year. Conscription. Ursula von der Leyen said that Finnish bomb shelters are the model for the rest of Europe. There's been talk in Starmer's UK about mass conscription for many months before this document or this new doctrine appeared. But it's certainly the worst nightmare for a predatory European elite, which depends entirely on the United States for their own power. But I want to go back to your last question about Russia and China. The loss of Syria has been more calamitous for Russia and China than are currently understood. For China, Syria is now a base of organizing for the East Turkestan Islamic Party or Islamic Movement, which carried out multiple mass casualty attacks in Xinjiang throughout the 2000s. And they are now essentially being integrated into the Syrian military. They could come back and attack China, but Syria fell because Russia was pinned down in Ukraine, because China was muted and they essentially did nothing. And Iran was facing its own situation with Israel after October 7th. So the IRGC and Russia essentially pulled out and Syria collapsed. While Venezuela is in an entirely different hemisphere, it is something that Russia and China might understand through the Syrian experience, have to be taken more seriously. And at the same time, Nicolas Maduro and Venezuela have always been focused on negotiating and relations with the U.S. There are refineries in Texas waiting for Venezuelan crude. But right now, only Chevron has the license to pump oil in Venezuela. And I think the government in Caracas is eager for a deal, but the Trump administration is currently only listening to this radical ideological faction based in South Florida who see the United States as nothing more than an aircraft carrier for them to settle the scores of their former countries, where they're primed to carry out atrocities, and they're organized behind Maria Corina Machado, someone who has formally called on Israel to invade Venezuela. This is disastrous.
Finally, is that kind of the lesson of 2025? And before that, they may have not read your great book, The Management of Savagery, that countries that fail to understand the savage nature of empire have to then catch up later on. I mean, Iran is still talking to the IAEA. I'm not sure why that's happening. Countries like Russia, which believed the Minsk process, China, as you say, didn't react quick enough on Syria. Is that the lesson of 2025, that powers have to understand the rapacious nature of the United States much earlier on as events unfold?
I think the management of savagery was written for an American audience, and the lesson is for them that their intelligence agencies, the national security state, is not acting in their interest. It has traditionally paid and armed forces that have attacked them, that have no interest in their safety or national security, in order to settle geopolitical scores. And it's not just jihadists, it's also drug traffickers, narco traffickers. And that's a point that I've been making again and again, is that the CIA literally created out of whole cloth this cartel of the Suns during the Reagan era to ship drugs into the United States to raise money for black operations and supposedly surveil drug trafficking routes. And now the cartel of the Suns, which hasn't existed since then, has been dusted off to justify the $50 million bounty on Nicolas Maduro's head and the narco-terrorist designation, which allows the Trump administration's extra-constitutional show of force and essentially a war on Venezuela. And this is something that continues to this day, the U.S. intelligence working with narco-traffickers and jihadists against the will of the American public. So that book, the lesson is for the American public, and I think it's a lesson the American public has learned. You can see the suspicion and critical perspective of the American public as the Trump administration and other forces try to stoke fear of everything from the Turtle Island Liberation Front to Palestine solidarity. They're questioning this era that we're in that I would call the years of engraved lead.
Max Blumenthal, thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for the show. Our continued condolences to those bereaved by the UK-US-EU armed genocide across Palestine, Lebanon, and Syria. We'll be back on Monday with historian Professor Richard Spence, who spent decades tracing secret societies and hidden power networks shaping the political elites behind US-UK-EU militarism. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media if it's not censored in your country, and head to our channel, Going Underground TV on Rumble.com, to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Monday.